It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name's Leia Harris, and so good to be on the podcast. I identify as someone who's a suicide attempt survivor. The first time I remember being suicidal, I was 7 years old, and have struggled with suicidal thoughts on and off in my life, as well as the various responses that we get in society to being suicidal. So I've been in the back of cop cars, ambulances, emergency rooms. So it's, you know, the whole trauma that goes with being a suicide attempt survivor, as well as suicide in and of itself being traumatic. In my mid-20s, I, you know, got involved in various radical movements and started to present on, you know, these kinds of subjects, talking about psychiatry and suicide and mental health and kind of how they figure in to a lot of the stresses that activist communities face. I presented on the stuff at, you know, the National Conference on Organized Resistance in D.C. Maybe some of y'all might remember that conference that went on for quite a lot of years.
Golden oldie there.
Golden oldie. Yeah, I am really aging myself, dating myself right now. So it was really, that was the beginning of my work, you know, the early 2000s, and just kind of trying to raise awareness around these issues kind of from a critical stance, from an activist stance, from a perspective of social justice. That's what I got for now.
I'm Cody. I am an activist based out of so-called Denver, Colorado. I've been on the podcast before. I talked about opiates. I'm really glad to be back to be talking about this. I'm also somebody who, I have a handful of psychiatric labels, that have been given to me over the years. I'm, a suicide attempt survivor and, multiple suicide attempt survivor. I'm somebody who also experiences suicidal intensity and suicidal thoughts on a pretty regular basis. I've been hospitalized a handful of times and experienced, you know, sort of the wrath of, the psychiatric pharmaceutical industrial complex, and sort of, you know, out of my experiences of, you know, mental health challenges and mental health conditions, and my own, you know, my own sort of desperation, I have found myself in an activist space. I think, you know, for me, traditional mental health hasn't really helped me so much as you know, fighting for autonomy and things like that within the mental health system. And I met Leia through this work, and her and I have gotten very close over the years. And we, you know, we often present together at you know, conferences and things like that on you know, suicide and how we can sort of radically shift our thinking on suicide. Because it's, you know, it's not something that impacts just people with mental health conditions or psychiatric labels. And in fact, it impacts many, many, many people without those things. You know, what we're finding is that, traditional mental health treatments and approaches to suicide are not helping. The suicide rates are going up. And, you know, the field of suicidology, is sort of split into two spaces, really, two schools of thought, that I kind of want to introduce before we jump in. And, so we have, sort of what I refer to as establishment suicidology, which is like the traditional, it's really informed by traditional, spaces of mental health treatment. So, that's psychopharmacology, big pharma, psychiatry, and like the mental health industrial complex of like treatment programs and AA and, you know, medications and 60, 90 day stays in hospitalizations and things like that. It sort of, puts suicide within a person as something to be pathologized. So like if you're suicidal, that means that there's something, it's inside of you and there's something broken about you that we must fix. And you know, that's sort of school of thought has, well, it's not working in terms of addressing the issue. And so there's this other school of thought as well. And it's the critical suicidology lens. And Leia can speak more to this, but critical suicidology sort of views suicide through a lens of intersectionality and, you know, sees suicidal thoughts and suicide as like a totally understandable response to a fucked up world. And so, you know, as our different identities intersect, it can sort of place us in a space where things can feel really desperate and really awful. And that's because, you know, there are certain things like lack of access to care and, you know, consistent ability to keep a roof over your head and, you know, not having to deal with oppressive systems and being, you know, consistently violated for being Black or brown or queer, that all of those things, you know, all of our intersecting identities really, can, because the way the world is and because of capitalism and white supremacy and things like that, that it can, you know, it can feel really desperate and really hopeless and that's, you know, suicide, desire to die comes out of a space of feeling that way and that's totally understandable given how fucked up the world is. So anyway, that's my little introduction.
And we're going to be talking about, picking apart a lot of this stuff, unpacking it, looking at both kind of how the state and corporations have responded to this, but kind of before we even get into those questions, I just kind of wanted to ask both of you, you know, if you pop into a search engine, you know, rising suicide rates, you know, there's a lot of stuff that comes out. And actually this conversation came out of, stuff we were talking about on This Is America, but as many people know, like the, you know, life expectancy in the US is going down actually in part to, increasing suicide rates. Here's one article on PBS. It's talking about how suicide was the 10th most common cause of death among Americans of all ages in 2017. But if you go to the Zoomer generation, younger people ages 15 to 24, it became the second leading cause of death, which is, I mean, huge. And actually, if you break down, there's been more studies that show when you break it down, by race, as you were saying, you know, Black and brown kids are experiencing higher rates of suicide than others. And in terms of kind of a class lens, here's another article from CNBC. It's talking about the U.S. suicide rate has risen 40% over 17 years, with blue collar workers the highest at risk. So, I mean, I think these numbers are very shocking to a lot of people. And obviously this flies in the face of what we hear from the mainstream and especially from, you know, the Trump administration about how great the economy is doing. Everybody has a job. Things are wonderful. We're tired of winning. So then why is it that it seems to correlate with the rise of financialization and neoliberalism that, you know, suicide rates are going out the window? And this isn't something like, I think, like with the rise of like mass school shootings, some of this stuff has almost been painted as like, people that are just alienated or, you know, they listen to the wrong kind of music and they have these kind of feelings. But these numbers are showing like, you know, people are responding, like you were saying, to real everyday stresses and oppression. And this is leading to lots of people very tragically taking their own lives. So I'm just curious, you know, like in your own opinion, in your analysis, what is happening in the country that's causing these numbers to show?
So, yeah, you know, just a simple and easy little breezy question. It's truly the thing to understand about suicide is that it's so multidimensional, right? And as so many factors influence suicide over different times, you brought up so many different dimensions just in your question, whether it's race, class, we didn't even get into the sort of the gendered aspect of it, right? But I think what we can say overall is that, you know, we have a combination of rising inequality, right? No matter what an orange person in office might say, we have a condition where any kind of semblance of a social safety net that we ever might have had in our society is unraveling at an increasingly rapid clip. And another dimension that really doesn't get talked about is that certainly not everybody gets equal access to care. But, you know, we see these rising suicide rates as more and more people are accessing mental health treatment, like psychiatric medications. And if you take psych meds and they're helping you, this is not at all, you know, about that. But really, you know, I did some work in 2004 with a whole bunch of people. The Food and Drug Administration, looking at how a lot of these commonly prescribed antidepressants that people might just get from, you know, their regular doctor, not even like a psychiatrist, can cause people to be suicidal. They can increase, you know, suicidality. And we, as a result of all of us, you know, fighting in 2004, we did manage to get a black box warning put on those drugs to say, hey, just be aware that sometimes if you raise the dose or if you stop these drugs or go on these drugs, you can become suicidal. You can become more suicidal. So there's another dimension there is that maybe some of these pharmaceutical industry, you know, funded cures are actually making people worse. So that's happening. More and more people are accessing treatment. And my colleague, Derek Blumke, looked at the Veterans Administration data, and they actually found that veterans who had access to care at the VA had higher rates of suicide than those who did not get care at the VA. And the theory and the understanding behind that is that mostly at the VA, what you'll get is a prescription and not much else. You're very lucky if you could even access therapy, right? Let alone community support, right? So that's just even one dimension of it, is that some of these treatments might be causing harm. And then finally, I do not take any position about guns, but I just want to say we have more guns in this country than people. And so there's a ton of access to weapons, you know, for people who want to take their own lives or to commit some kind of interpersonal violence. So there's just the access, right, to the weaponry that makes it possible. So just kind of those are all the different kinds of factors, you know, that I think even just kind of scratch the surface of what might be happening, you know, here, particularly in the U.S.
I want to jump in also. I think, you know, there's another one of the many facets is so if you're, you know, you might be lucky enough to have access to treatments, right? And so you go in and maybe you do get on a prescription. You know, if you're somebody that is has trouble like keeping a job, for instance, your access might be inconsistent at best. And that happens, you know, a lot for a lot of people. And so even just like going on a medication and then coming off of it very quickly and then going back on it. I mean, like what that does, and in my own experience, what that has done is caused some like really brutal like physical responses to things, and you know, just wanting to crawl out of my skin looking for an escape is it like that became very prevalent for me as I was like navigating pharmacology, so to speak. And then, you know, there's this other aspect of like, sure, you know, we've got low unemployment rates and that's like great, but you know, people are living to work, and that's not a life worth living. And, And I think we're seeing that. Like, just because a person has a job doesn't, that doesn't mean that a person is fulfilled. And if what we're doing is living to work, you know, that can cause some desperation and some hopelessness. And, but I think, you know, there's this piece of it that's like, you know, sure, people can say that we've got these low unemployment rates and things like that, but like, that doesn't necessarily mean that life is worth living. And people are looking for ways out of that. And sometimes when we get tunnel vision and things get dark enough, the way out is through death. And like that for me, that's very valid. That's a very valid response.
We're going to dive into some more questions here before the interview. You were talking about how there's been misinformation out there relating to suicide and how it gets turned out by mainstream media and perpetuated by big pharma and, you know, various other big corporations and networks of power. Can you talk about this misinformation? And also, why do these big companies have a stake in promoting it?
Yeah, I think the big sort of overarching myth and, you know, maybe some of the listeners have heard it, it's this phrase that gets just sort of repeated everywhere. 90% of all suicide is caused by an underlying mental health condition, right? And this statistic is spun out everywhere, right? In the public, in the mass media, on social media. And I really consider this to be a form of mass gaslighting, kind of what Cody was talking about, that suicide is this individualistic issue, right? So if you're struggling, it has to be something that's a problem with you or a mental disorder located within you, rather than a broader issue within society, you know, that is causing distress, that is causing you to want to die. So it's, again, locating that issue within the individual. And that statistic isn't even true. I mean, it's absolute disinformation. It's based on a practice called psychological autopsy, which has now kind of become this sort of gold standard. But it's not even really valid science. There's no reliability. There's no validity. There's serious methodological weaknesses, right? Which, you know, how we actually define science is that you should be able to repeat it again, you know, over time with valid results. And so there's a lot of people and industries who benefit from this myth that suicide is caused by a mental health condition, right? If the whole issue with suicide is it's just a mental health condition, then, oh, all we need to do is get you into treatment, right? Get you on a medication. You might get therapy if you're lucky, but most of the time treatment equals medication or it equals hospitalization, right? And so who does that benefit? Who or what, right? Big pharma, insurance industries, all of these different industries that are profiting off of our pain, right? And that the pain is always addressed through this narrow medical model, right? And that suicide is seen as synonymous with mental illness. It's seen as pathology and disorder, right? And that benefits a lot of industries that stand to profit off us for life, right? Because that's what they tell people, right? If you go on a medication, more likely than not, you'll have to be on this medication for life. So again, they have these lifelong patients now. And again, as we've established, while some people might find these drugs useful, they can actually make things worse for a number of people, right? Including increasing suicidality. And that's something that sort of rarely, if ever, gets talked about in the mainstream media.
So recently there was a New York Times article that came out that addressed youth suicide. And whenever young people are dying, it's a big deal. That's not something I will ever argue. It is a big deal when our children are dying. And, when our children are taking their own lives, it's pretty horrifying. And I think another myth is that suicide is singularly caused. When it's not singularly caused. It's, sort of a perfect storm of situations that lead people to want to die by suicide. And that's how it is for anybody that dies by suicide. And so like trying to reduce suicide to a specific singular cause is not accurate. And it's an oversimplification of a much more complicated issue. And it doesn't really, you know, by perpetuating a myth like that, it keeps us from exploring things beyond just that maybe one thing. You know, one of the myths that we heard with youth suicide is that bullying causes suicide. But nobody ever talks about the fact that people who bully, young people who bully, are actually far more likely to die by suicide than people who are bullied. And so, you know, there, I think, like, the mainstream media and these huge industrial complexes that profit off of our pain would prefer to, you know, give us invalid information because it's scary and it makes us react really quickly in the moment. And when we do that, we're not actually taking people's best interests in mind. We're just sort of making these snap decisions without thinking about the ramifications or the consequences.
You know, one thing I wanted to go back to, you were saying there's a rise in people being put on drugs and that's correlating also to more people killing themselves. I'm just curious if you can speak a little more to that. I know a lot of people that might be something that would shock them, that basically with more people seeing a doctor and then being put on medication, that is then turning to them harming themselves.
Yeah, I mean, you can really trace it with the rise of antidepressants, right? The Prozac came out in 1988, I believe. And, you know, ever since then, there's just been an increasing rise in the numbers of Americans of all ages who are on a whole variety of antidepressant medications. And, you know, that tracks pretty much, you know, with that rising suicide rate, that more people are accessing care. But is the care causing harm? This is another issue. So medications are the sort of one go-to, right, to sort of treat the quote unquote underlying mental illness that we've established in, you know, is a scientific fallacy. So there's that, but then there's also, hospitalization, right? So you think, hey, somebody's in a suicidal crisis. Of course we have to hospitalize them. What are other options? But what we know is that while that hospitalization, and I'm living proof of this, it may save that person's life in the short term. We know from a whole ton of data that, actually it puts people at greater risk for suicide over the long term, right? So that first, 72 hours at least, you know, there's various studies that look at different time periods after discharge from a psychiatric hospital, and that person is much, much more likely to attempt suicide in that time period, right? So our go-to standard ways of responding to suicide, you know, medications and hospitalization, right? These are actually causing what is called iatrogenic harm. It's harm that's caused by the treatment. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case for everybody, you know, of course, but there's a subset of people that are really, really harmed by the pharmaceutical treatments and by, you know, what happens as a result of hospitalization, right? So, you know, again, you can really track over the last 30 years that, you know, again, not everybody has equal access to care. Of course, you know, it's people of color, you know, folks who are marginalized in our society are not in general accessing that care. But there is overall a rise in access to the psychiatric system, you know, through a whole variety of systems, right? It's not just, you know, it might be your regular, you know, medical doctor, could be a psychiatrist. It could be through any system that you find yourself in, whether it's the foster system, the prison system. All of these systems rely on psychotropic drugs to sort of maintain order.
And I think that, you know, the way that we as a society respond to suicide crisis is really problematic and really dangerous. And, you know, as Leah was saying, hospitalizations, while they keep people safe, like in that, you know, 72 hours you're on a hold or whatever, suicide ideation can spike right after that because of the atrocities that are committed within the walls of hospitals. I know my first hospitalization, I was forced treated and I was young. I was still underage. And, you know, I had some things happen to me during that time that have stayed with me over the years. You know, a person came into my bed while I was hospitalized. I had all autonomy stripped from me. You know, if you're a person that experiences a suicidal crisis, and somebody calls, you know, 911, then police respond and you are handcuffed and then put in a hospital. And, you know, once you're in there, it's really hard to have any amount of say in your treatment, because, you know, you're labeled as crazy, and, you know, part of the activist community that Leia and I are in, we're, you know, I'm not sure if Leia would use this term for herself, but I certainly use the term mad activist, and mad pride. And we're sort mm-hmm. of like, you know, reclaiming madness, mm-hmm. because madness has been, you know, our mental health experience, and our madness and our trauma have been weaponized against us and weaponized against many, many, many millions of people. And, you know, being labeled as such means that you are no longer a valid reporter of your experience. And that is scary and dangerous. And for me, when my suicidal intensity gets really, really loud, it usually means that I am feeling trapped in some way. And that comes from trauma and having had my autonomy taken from me in the past. So, you know, but this is not specific to just me either. When people have their autonomy stripped from them, when we have our rights taken away from us, death looks like a better option. Because imprisonment is scary, whether it's psychiatric imprisonment or, you know, incarceration, the way we see it at, with the prison industrial complex or with the concentration camps at the border. You know, all of these things are scary and awful and can lead a person to think that it would be better to be dead than to be alive. And there is some validity in that.
There's a monster under my bed, and at my window there's a dragon. I accepted the challenge, it turned me into a savage. I broke a promise to myself again. I don't know why I am so vulnerable. They try to help, but I won't let them in. Guess rock bottom's where I'm comfortable. Both my feet planted when most people would have panicked. I embraced the storm. I found beauty in what was damaged. I'm not afraid of the boogeyman. Instead, I look at him like he's a friend. There's not a monster out there in the world that's scarier than the one that's within. There's a creature in my closet. I can hear him rumbling around. The demon screaming in the distance creates such a humbling sound. The monster that's outside my window, he's like family to me now. The things that people are afraid of never let me down.
Not to say this, no, but I'm hated so. My religious freaks say I'm the biggest beast and that I made it grow. When I spray this flow, I created mo. Creatures are like when I heat up the mic, I'm a breed of the night, but I'm tainted though. By the darkness I'm binded, I sparked it and shined it. They find it cause mine is woe. But that they label me a demon seed. Wanna disable, need to see them bleed. Hinder me fatally and see them grieve, no. You would not believe the creature inside me. If you deceive, Khalifa's a lively. We disagree when people defy me or try to take his. Whatever the fuckery taught him, you don't wanna wake this. You forsake his with a sacred, then it's over. No matter what your faith is, I'm a creature.
There's a creature in my closet. I can hear him rumbling around. The demon screaming in the distance creates such a humbling sound. The monster that's window, he's like family to me now. The things that people are afraid of never let me down.
Yeah, I managed to get myself in trouble, all of this pain. Yeah, I'm damn in the double dose of liquor's always to blame. If I could keep myself sober, I keep my hands to myself. I take a shot and it's over, that's how I end up in hell. Hope I don't pass it down to my offspring. They get everything from their daddy, feel like I'm addicted to all things. There's no reason to change, gone too far now. And I'm stuck in my ways, back at the bar now.
perking and purposely searching for something that's hurting me so. I just can't pack up and go. I just back out of it slow. That's how it go. I got the back out the hole. What next? Like I don't know.
Okay.
I think he be laughing at me. Hands be grabbing at me. Feel like God let it happen till we dabby blast from me. And these be a dabby dash really.
Okay. Yeah.
I think I better let it go. Either that or I gotta let it know. And I can't do that.
There's a creature in my closet. I can hear him rumbling around. The demon screaming in the distance creates such a humbling sound. The monster that's outside my window, he's like family to me now. The things that people are afraid of never let me down.
You were saying that currently in the mainstream there are two schools of thought about the rise of suicide rates. You mentioned one. This is in our notes before. There's the neoliberal field of suicidology, which sort of centers suicide as a problem residing within the human. And there's the field of critical suicidology, which sees suicide as an understandable response to oppressive systems. So how do you view these critiques, and how do these either hit or miss the reality of what we're seeing happen?
I think critical suicidology emerged as a response to the neoliberal school of suicidology. And for the most part, it's within the academy, but I think it's sort of growing among, you know, folks who are not necessarily academically affiliated, and I hope is starting to kind of catch on a bit more in the grassroots. But yeah, as Cody shared, it's an intersectional approach that I think is much more of a way of understanding the complexity of suicide that does some kind of justice to the complexity that really comes from feminist theory. It's interdisciplinary, right? It's not just looking through this narrow medical lens at our lived experience. So it's bringing in feminist theory, queer theory, critical race theory, and disability justice, right? And why I also have hope in this approach is that it's really, again, even though it's kind of come out of the academy, there is this belief that, you know, if we're going to do what is, you know, quote, suicide prevention work or anything related to this work, we need to be centering the perspectives of people who have lived it, right? So it's sort of flipping that script to where, you know, the medical authorities in that neoliberal model are the only experts, right? And we're just to kind of be the passive, obedient patients or the passive, obedient recipients of suicide prevention propaganda, right? The critical suicidology perspective is really about centering the lived experience and that really honoring that people have the wisdom and the answers within them. And that, you know, for example, I'll just give you a concrete example of the difference between a critical suicidology perspective and, you know, the kind of business as usual. If you think about these curricula that are taught in schools, right, these one size fits all suicide prevention or mental health curricula that just, again, kind of just feed students a lot of propaganda. And it's one size fits all, manualized, right? Probably designed by a bunch of middle-aged Caucasian people versus a critical suicidology perspective that says, no, you know, teachers, adults should support young people to have these conversations. We shouldn't shove our agenda, you know, into their brains, but we should really allow them to lead the conversation and to talk about what, you know, they think these things mean, what does suicide mean to them, and to be much more in a place of solidarity with young people rather than power over. So that's just one example. So it feels much more aligned, I think, with the approaches that we need that are going to sort of really help communities figure out how they can support one another, right? Because the answer to suicide is not going to come from the government. It's not going to come from these top-down federal agencies or initiatives, right? I do believe that it's going to be within each individual community that needs to figure out how are we going to practice collective care and resistance in a way that will cause more people to want to stay here and be here with us.
Critical suicidology has always existed. and has, you know, when deinstitutionalization happened, for instance, during the 50s and 60s, after JFK signed the community mental health legislation, and basically, you know, deinstitutionalized and opened up all the doors to all the asylums, peer support, which we can get into in a second, people were basically coming out of these asylums, these hospitals, these state hospitals, and not having anywhere to go or anyone to help them navigate the world. You know, these are people who had been written off by their families and loved ones and didn't have anyone, didn't know how to get a job or open a bank account, much less, you know, find a home. And so what was happening was, people were sort of coming together, in these encampments outside of these giant hospitals and taking care of one another. And that's where peer support was born. And that, you know, peer support has sort of been replicated over the years. But I think, you know, peer support has been a facet of critical suicidology where it hasn't existed in sort of academia necessarily, but people have found ways to take care of each other and survive outside of oppressive systems. And, you know, maybe we haven't necessarily had the language for it. And so critical suicidology has really done that to show that, like, you know, there's more to suicide than pathology. In fact, you know, maybe pathology doesn't have so much to do with suicide at all. And maybe these like giant oppressive systems and our intersecting identities, and the way the world, you know, views us has more to do with the pain that we experience, than, you know, a diagnosis could speak to. But then also like, then how do we take care of each other? And I think, you know, where, critical suicidology is gaining traction in academic spaces, we have seen, you know, what happens when people sort of like throw away the diagnostic crap and come together to support each other, and that can be way more helpful and valuable than, you know, the things that we think are typically helpful, like, you know, treatment, hospitalization, and medications.
We've seen now decades of people being put on, you know, big pharma drugs. I know, I mean, personally, just watching friends, you know, after decades of being on some of this stuff, try to come off it, you know, it's been some of the most difficult things they've ever had to go through. I'm just curious, you know, what do you see as, you know, what effects are we seeing? You know, just people that have literally grown up on these drugs.
So I am someone that's been on medications off and on since I was 13 years old. I'm now in my 30s. So like half of my life, I've been on these really, really gnarly drugs. I decided last February that I was going to come off my medication. And I was lucky enough to be able to do it under... with the support of my psychiatrist, at the time. I was really naive so I was on Effexor, and many, many, many people are. And, the way that people describe the withdrawal symptoms of coming off a drug like Effexor is, similar to heroin withdrawal, where it impacts, you know, certainly the way, like, you are, able to, like, your cognition, but also, like, there are very, extreme physical symptoms. I tapered over the course of a month, and it was entirely too fast. I, you know, hindsight's 2020, everything I had read about it had told me that I should have done it over the course of a year, but I was hell bent on getting off of this stuff. And you know, at one point I lost my vision. At one point I couldn't hear. You know, I was shaking. I was like having convulsions and tremors. I, you know, like night sweats and hearing things and seeing things. And, it was just a very violent experience for me. And that's sort of what happens to your body 24 hours after you miss a dose. That can start happening. And so it took me, I would say, like 6 months before, I wasn't in like physical pain. So, you know, that I preface this sort of response with you know, my own sort of story, because, you know, it is no walk in the park to come off a psychotropic medication. It is incredibly devastating to the system. It can cause all kinds of things, including things like job loss, because if you can't see, you can't get to work. Now, I work for an organization that was really understanding and knew exactly what I was going through. And, you know, I'm very lucky. But for other people, you know, like being put on medications sort of puts people in a box where they become systems dependent, because, you know, if you're somebody on a substance like this and you miss a dose, you immediately go into withdrawal, and it is so uncomfortable that, like, people are planning out their schedules around when they can get access to their medications, and planning out their day around when they can take their medications. And so coming, you know, after having done that, this is like sort of all besides the cost alone. The cost alone is extraordinary and can be devastating for people. Because, you know, if a medication doesn't work, then what happens is we up that medication, and then we'll try another medication, and then we'll try another medication on top of that. So, you know, then you're completely dependent on your psychiatrist and probably your primary care physician as well, if you have access to one, because a lot of these medications require a number of testing regularly, checking blood levels, checking, you know, doing x-rays and CAT scans and all kinds of different things just to make sure that the medications aren't completely destroying your body to the point where, you know, you might be like put in like the medical hospital. And so, like, you know, you're dependent on your psychiatrist, you're dependent on your primary care physician. And you may not even be able to, you know, depending on the side effects of medications, you may not be able to hold down a job. So, you know, then you sort of hit this sort of different space of systems dependency, which is, you know, getting on disability and things like that. And that really sucks too, because, you know, at that point, then if you are able to do a little bit of work, well, you can't make over a certain amount of money, or you lose your disability benefits. So it's just this insidious web that keeps people trapped. And, you know, and then when people try and come off, some folks don't survive that. Some folks experience unbearable pain, and so suicide can then become an answer to that as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in too and say there's a specific adverse effect that you described. It's called akathisia, and it is this agitated, like, inner sense of wanting to, like, jump out of your skin. I've had it. I've experienced it. And that is something that's associated with not just antidepressants, but, you know, what are neuroleptics or called antipsychotic drugs, can cause this, just unbearable. It's like emotional pain, but it's just this like physical agitated kind of restlessness. And then just something else I wanted to add is that, we have a really, really serious problem with informed consent when it comes to these medications. People are told, like, yeah, try this, you know, da, 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 da. If that doesn't work, we'll try something else. But rarely, if ever, are people, do doctors explain to people that they, you know, could have really difficulty, in withdrawing, from these drugs, right? And frankly, the medical providers rarely know how to deprescribe. It's a huge issue. You know, you're very lucky if you find a prescriber who's willing to deprescribe or hang in with you through that process. They often just want to wash their hands of it. So it's very easy generally, you know, to somehow, if you have the means or the ability to get these prescriptions, it's easy to obtain the prescription. But then to actually be able to come off, it's hard to get good information on that. You know, people started 20 years ago with these antidepressants. You know, there was like this underground where people started sharing information because they weren't getting it from the doctors or the medical establishment or the FDA, right? And so, you know, that's slowly starting to change, where there's this awareness in the medical community. Hey, we need to actually know how to withdraw people from these drugs, or do it safely at the very least, right? There needs to be some protocols. But there's still a lot of resistance in the medical community to it.
Recently, I was listening to an author has a new book on AK Press, Resisting Illegitimate Authority. The author's name is Bruce Levine. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, his whole take is that essentially the market drive around pharmaceuticals has driven companies to make more and more kind of diagnoses about people. And a lot of these have to do with, you know, kids, you know, and everybody's kind of like intrinsic resistance to authority, and that there's a drive by the system to label things like, you know, oppositional defiant disorder, and then pump them full of drugs, which serves to pacify the population, but then also to create more markets to then, you know, sell lots of pharmaceuticals to. I'm just curious your thoughts on this, you know, take.
Well, I really appreciate Bruce Levine's work. And I think there's, yeah, absolutely a great deal of validity to what he's saying. That the pharmaceutical industry, it's well known. They create markets, they create diseases, and they create markets through advertising. They've always spent more on direct to consumer and medical advertising than they even have on research and development, right? So this is PR. And so they are, they buy the advocacy groups, and then the advocacy group hypes it up. And, you know, they have a whole system, right, by which they, you know, create markets for new drugs. and so, you know, I think, yeah, the avenues for resistance are many. I think we need to really, excuse me. I think we really need to, educate each other around these medications. Again, this is not for anyone to feel ashamed if you're on these drugs. That's the last of any of our intentions. But we need to really be educating each other, about how to safely withdraw, how to find alternative methods of coping and surviving in this world, right? If, you know, we know that, in the long term, these medications are not going to work for everybody. We have to have alternative approaches to this. But yeah, ultimately, I think that this is about the pharmaceutical industry wants us to be, you know, they bought the politicians, you know, they work together in cahoots. They would want us to be pacified, you know, medicalized, psychiatrized, preoccupied with our own individual pain, and not really able to see beyond that, and see that it is a collective pain that we're facing.
I'm just curious, you know, with all this in mind, how can we respond to what's going on?
Yes, there is. It's in peer support. And so I mean peer support in like really just like being there for one another. And there are some things that we can do. You know, I think like certainly finding, you know, communities that, that sort of have the same politics in terms of like, if you're feeling suicidal, I will not call the police on you. Let's come up with another plan. There's currently peer support is being sort of co-opted by community mental health. And, where there are peer support programs, I encourage people if they are comfortable approaching those programs to please do that. So in order to do peer support, the sort of, marker or, like professional credential is lived experience. So it's a person who has gone through some shit helping another person who's going through some shit. And that's, you know, a very oversimplified version of it, but to me, in my experience, peer support has been the thing that has helped me. Certainly activism has too. Organizing is still integral to giving me reasons to stay alive. But when things get really bad for me, personally, I have a group of friends who also experience suicidal intensity, off and on in their lives. And I know that they are people who can be trusted, who aren't going to hospitalize me. In fact, I've worked on it, like psychiatric advanced directives with some of, like my people, so that, you know, if I'm not in a position to make decisions for myself, that there's someone else who can, who I trust, to make the right decisions. You know, there's a certain amount of like, transparency that I have with my group of people, where like if I'm feeling really, really acutely very intense suicidal ideation, then, you know, they'll come take the weapons out of my home, or, come stay with me for a couple of days. You know, it's, the thing about suicide is, I think a lot of us experience like passive suicidal intensity. That's not like I'm going to kill myself today. But just sort of this, God, if things get bad enough, I might consider this. But then when things really spike, it usually lasts for up to 72 hours. That's why they put people on 72 hour holds. So if you can help get your friends and loved ones through that 72 hour period of like real intense desire to die, that chances are they're going to come out of it and things are going to chill for a little bit. And so, like, you know, having direct conversations with the people that you trust and that you know have your best interests in mind about, hey, when things get really bad, this is what I need to have happen. Or, you know, this is what I would like for you to do to help me through this. I think that that's, you know, that's really informal peer support, but like, that's the thing. That's the thing that helps people. It's not, you know, calling the police and forcing people to, you know, engage in hospitalization. I will say that if that's part of what people want, that's great. And we should honor that, but that, you know, we don't have to do that. That's not the gold standard, because currently we don't have a gold standard. Because the things that are traditionally employed when people are suicidal are not working. So, you know, I think like connectedness, giving people a community that's bigger than themselves to plug into and something meaningful to provide to said community. These are all things that make people feel connected, that make people want to live. Leah, what you got?
So yeah, I think that was fantastic, and I don't have too much more to add, but just that, I think we need to really, teach the skills of being with each other, through crises, right? And so that, yeah, that's everything from, you know, what Cody was saying, you know, kind of having a plan, right? Like when I'm in distress, like these are some of the things that happen. These are some of the supports that I need. But also I think so often we are just so uncomfortable with being with someone who's in suicidal pain or who's experiencing suicidal intensity. And there's this understandable, intense desire to fix it, right? But that's where I think a lot of the sort of power and control can come in, even among friends, right? Even, right, among comrades. It's just out of that fear, and it's an understandable fear, right? Especially, you know, if you haven't had that direct experience yourself, although I think most people have to some degree or another, have had at least had fleeting thoughts about suicide. But yeah, just really teaching those skills to each other, doing those skill shares around how do we sit with discomfort? How do I want to be supported, right? How can I, you know, really have a consent-based response, right, within our communities? Because so often what happens is, you know, people have the police called on them, or they're taken to the hospital, really, and it's not necessarily a consensual thing. So again, you know, this can be scary, right? And it should never fall on, you know, one person to be a supporter of someone who's in crisis for days on end. And sometimes that happens. But really ideally, like figuring out how to have like, just I don't know how to describe it other than like a team of folks, a crew of folks, you know, that can sort of take turns supporting someone who is in crisis until they get through it. But honestly, it's having those skills of that are those peer support skills of being with, right? Not trying to fix, not trying to talk the person out of it, or not trying to make them feel guilty, but just listening, right? Being able to sit with it, you know, and you don't have to know how they feel, right? You can just be a compassionate presence for someone and be like, what do you need right now? And sometimes they might not know what they need, right? You could offer, well, you know, sometimes I go take a walk or I do this, right? And so there's ways to just always kind of be centering that person in crisis and be doing suicide support for someone who's suicidal from a consent-based kind of way of working.
I also want to add that I think I'm just going to make a plug here. Intentional peer support is a really, really great framework to work from if people are interested. And so if you just do a Google search of intentional peer support, there's a website and there's a workbook, and the workbook is $35. And I think, you know, if you're somebody that is interested in this, get that workbook, work through it. It, you know, it offers a lot of really great information and scenarios scenarios and things like that to help people think about what they might do if you know, if they were in a position to support another person. I think it helps us make sense of our own experience. And, you know, certainly if you're a person who, who's a loved one of somebody who experiences, you know, mental health crisis on and off, it's definitely worth getting your hands on because it can provide some really great information around that.
And one other resource I wanted to throw out there is this is a training, you know, that you may or may not, you know, be able to get to, but it's the Alternatives to Suicide Peer Support Facilitator Training that's put on by the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. And it's usually in Massachusetts, but sometimes it can be in other places. And so if you go to their website, they have a whole kind of section on alternatives to suicide, and you can even bring them to your community to train folks in your community how to lead these groups that are really specific to, you know, supporting each other through this experience of being suicidal, whatever it looks like at different points in time.
Do you want to throw out any other resources or ways people can follow your work or anything else you want to touch on?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Leia, LEAHIDA. And I do tweet a lot about mental health, intersectional politics connected to suicide, suicide prevention, all of those kind of things.
And, I'm around, I'm not so much on social media, but, you know, I do this work and certainly, follow Leia. Leia is a great resource and, Leia's doing exceptional work and really, pushing the field. And, anybody that, Leia points you in the direction to is also probably worth following as well.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.